This is tape two, side four. I'm Madeline Tauberg and Virginia Batts. We're interviewing Judy Grauer, continuing the interview on this tape of February 22nd, 1994. Judy, may I call you Judy?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Many people do.
Although your given name is Juliet. In our first tape, you talked about your marriage to Dr. Robert Grauer. And please tell us more about Dr. Grauer, because he did so many wonderful things. And we're particularly interested in his role in the laboratories at Allegheny General Hospital.
Well, I think I'd like to start out just telling you a little bit about my husband's background itself. His parents... his mother was from Romania, and his father was from Austria-Hungary, but they married in Romania, so he must have been living in Romania. There were quite a few children in the family. Bob was born in Romania. He came over here when he was about 2 years of age. His father had preceded him and got over here to get established, and then he brought the mother and the children over. They were raised in the Hill District, which was the area where the Jewish immigrant people lived.
How many siblings, may I interrupt?
Actually, he had two sisters and two brothers. He was, he was second or third from the oldest. You have to realize that by the time I married Bob, unfortunately, they were all deceased. They lived there. And they apparently had some very high standards about certain things. Having known my mother-in-law, she was living and lived with us. Or shall I say, I lived with her because I moved into their home after I was married. Two of his brothers died at a very early age from illnesses which today could have been cured. But unfortunately, there wasn't a cure for them then. His father, who had dealt in cattle in Romania, when he came to Pittsburgh, he certainly couldn't find cattle. He went into the bakery business with his mother's family, Tisherman Bakeries. Then eventually he had his own bakery, Grauer's, but this is why he went into that type of business. And I guess they did fairly well. They were never people of great means by any long shot, but they were able to care for each other. And they had certain standards. They kept a little house that they would go to in the country every summer out beyond Squickley in a little town called Glenfield. And I have seen pictures of them all swimming in the river. And the father would come out with a horse and buggy every weekend, but the family would stay there for the summer. He felt his family should be in the country. Bob's two brothers died at a very young age. His
The two brothers died young.
Yes, prior sisters. To my meeting my husband-to-be, both of the sisters had died. The older sister, Mary, who was married and had a child, Coleman Myers, who later lived with us, had died from an infection which she developed in the process of childbirth, and it was a septicemia, and unfortunately, again, we didn't have penicillins, and she passed away. His younger sister, Ruth, who I also never met, had finished college, but she also passed away, and as I look back now, I realize that it had to have been tuberculosis, although that was a hush-hush thing that people didn't discuss then. So there was Bob Grauer completely in charge of a household when he was about 19, 20 years of age. His father dropped dead in the bakery one night when Bob was with him when there were a real union strike. And Bob, at the age of 19, almost 20, became head of a household with his mother and the 1/6 sister, Ruth. He had been accepted in medical school after 2 years of college. And of course, when his father died, he was very naive. He just didn't show up. He couldn't go to medical school. He got himself a job in the railroad. working in the baggage department, worked there at night, worked at the Tisherman Bakery during the day, and had tremendous responsibilities, but saved up enough money. So the next fall, he goes, appears upon the scene, the day that the medical school is to start for that fall. And it's always been a standing joke with the old-timers at the medical school, many of them are not there any longer, that in walked this young man and went into the classroom, and his name was not on the roster. And when they asked him who he was, he said he was Robert Brower. And they said, we don't have you on the roster. And they sent him to the dean's office. And the dean's secretary said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I was accepted last year. And if I was good enough for last year, why wouldn't I be good enough for this year? He had no understanding of the politics involved. And he just presumed that, she said, well, you go home and we'll let you know. Well, of course, they called him at home that evening and told him to come to school. Even the way he got into medical school, he went to two doctors in the Hill District who were Jewish doctors that he knew in the area, but they really weren't highly respected, and they were almost jokes as far as the medical school was concerned. And that's who signed his application. I won't mention the names. I don't think that would be very discreet.
May I ask which medical school?
The University of Pittsburgh. He was a very brilliant student. He did exceedingly well. And he went on to get a residency at Mercy Hospital, which was a Catholic hospital. He was the first Jew. Not that he particularly considered it an honor, but he chose Mercy because they had a very fine pathologist there, and he wanted to go into the field of pathology. So he did go into the field of pathology for his residency, for his internship and residency. And then he was offered a position over at Allegheny General Hospital. Again, a very Presbyterian institution. Again, being the only Jew. And again, that didn't impress him. There was someone over there. He thought that he would go into surgery, and there was someone over there who was very good. As it turned out, he went into the laboratory, worked with the man who was in charge of the laboratory, whose name was Samuel Haythorne, was pretty well world-renowned. And Bob worked there as the main pathologist for many, many years. He then went away for a while to Harvard, this was all prior to our marriage, and got training in endocrinology. And he came back to Pittsburgh, and he was the first endocrinologist in this city. During these periods of years, he published many papers individually and with his research staff at the hospital. And they made him the head of the William H. Singer Memorial Research Institute. Once Dr. Haythorne passed away, they gave him the dual job of the directorship of all of the laboratories and the research institute. So he was running all the clinical laboratories for the hospital and all the research for the hospital. And under that time, there were over 100 people that were under his employee, and it was an individual, separate wing, three-story wing of the hospital.
What is the William H. Singer Memorial Institute? Just what did that research do?
Well, the Singer family from Sewickley Heights, the Singers were in business with Andrew Carnegie. And I don't want to digress, but interestingly enough, if any of you read the book by Marcia Davenport, which was all about Pittsburgh, I can't think of the name of it at this moment. It's on my shelf somewhere. Well, anyway, she took different people from Pittsburgh and changed their affiliations. And one of the Singer family was the man who supposedly went off to Norway and became a priest. The truth of the matter, he went off to Norway and became an artist. And during the occupation, the German occupation, he was interned. The painting I have over there is a William H. Singer Jr. painting. He studied with the Impressionist painters, and that is a scene on the Seine. I bought it many years later. We found it in an antique shop in Sewickley, and Bob recognized it immediately, and we had it restored, reframed, and purchased it because it had great meaning to him. I will tell you this, at the time I was not active at the museum, I did not know it, but the museum, Carnegie Institute Museum, has many Singer paintings, and there is also a Museum in Hagerstown, Maryland, given by Singer's widow, that it is just for Singer paintings. So it's just an interesting thing. Now, Bob was very active, and frankly, he started practicing endocrinology to enhance his income. He would come home from the hospital maybe at 3 in the afternoon, 2 afternoons a week early. Of course, he'd get there around 6:30 or 7, and see private patients in the front part of our house. We had a separate entrance into the office from the outside, a separate entrance that he could go in from his consulting room into the house, and he ran a lucrative practice there. And frankly, for what physicians were paid as pathologists in large institutions, we needed the extra income. He also, in order to enhance his income, went to New Kensington Hospital. Every Friday night, I would drive down with him, where he would do the gross and the microscopic sections for the hospital.
Now, the Singer Laboratories, more or less, the Singer family
endowed,
did it do any specific type or just general research?
It was whatever the people that Bob employed would do. Bob's focus of interest was primarily thyroid, and he did a great deal of research on the thyroid gland. I would say that he was the authority in Pittsburgh on the thyroid gland.
I think we will have to stop. Yes, indeed. I know Dr. Grauer. I'm not supposed to tell what I know, but I know Dr. Grauer was an authority on thyroid. So that was their major research project at the time that he was the head of it.
But they had other projects. I mean, he did a lot of things on the sex glands. I mean, he actually had studied and followed through with one patient who was a true hermaphrodite, and he did a lot of research on that. Unfortunately, he never really published all the information he had, because it would have been an outstanding contribution. But as everything else, he was bogged down with he ran that laboratory. He hired, he fired. The laboratory in those days was a complete separate entity from the hospital. He had his own budget and all of that. So as he always said, once you become an administrator, you leave the bench, as the term is used, and you lose the technique of doing these things and writing them up. He did not have time for it. Unfortunately, there were a lot of people in town, knowing that he was a glandular doctor, that thought that he was there to put people on diets. And a lot of people would come to him on that basis. But his philosophy then was that glandular problems were very important, but most of the fat people were fat because of overeating, not for glandular problems.
But he did work on glandular problems concerning growth in youngsters,
definitely.
Particularly. He
particularly
did do that
with young boys. Many young boys would be brought to him by their parents who were very small and undeveloped sexually, and those children he did get great success with. Treated them with hormones, different injections, and of course, he was successful with that.
And he was ahead of his time then, too.
A lot ahead of his time then, well. And,
You said he had 100 employees under him at the hospital?
At least 100 employees.
Research
people. Because he had such a feeling for his employees that every year they would have this big Christmas party, and I personally had to shop and use his personal funds to buy everyone a Christmas gift. I should say they're really the hospital employees, Bob, but that was not the way he figured. He was an extremely kind and generous human being. Had very, very high standards of functioning, whether it's professionally or personally, and I think it was a privilege and honor to be married to such a person. And you, Madeline, did know him and know the high regard he was held in the community.
Indeed. And he was very devoted to his family, too.
Extremely devoted to his family. As I briefly mentioned, when we married, one of the reasons that we didn't marry earlier, I knew him for almost 4 years prior to our marriage, was the fact that his mother I had had a stroke and was living with him. They lived together, of course, and he just felt it would be too big a responsibility. Frankly, I left town a year before I got married because I felt that there was no point in my staying around, because Bob really could not make up his mind what he wanted to do. And I jokingly said to him, you know, I'm not planning to stay around and wait for your mother to pass on, because he felt it was too big a responsibility. However, I moved to Chicago, lived with my family there, worked there, and Bob came back and forth, and I felt that I could handle the situation. I will tell you right now that it was not an easy situation to handle. I had Bob's mother living with me with three nurses around the clock with her. I had his nephew living with me, who was going to medical school, who was much closer to my age than my husband was. Coleman was only 4 years younger than I. Bob was 16 years older than I. It was a very complex situation, but as I look back, I think I handled it extremely well. I took on responsibilities that I had never been accustomed to. I never discussed them with anyone, because this is something I chose to do. And even the difficult moments were never discussed with my parents. This was my responsibility, and I chose to take it on.
You never complained to your mother and father?
My friends never knew what was going on. No, I would never
complain. Not your parents either?
No.
So in other words, you were like your mother, who age 19 took on huge responsibility, and I guess it was inherent.
Well, whatever.
You did the same thing.
I was listening to some young women talking one day at lunch, and they were all complaining about their mother-in-laws. And I guess I had, when I become amused, I do get a rather, my friends tell me, enigmatic expression on my face. My husband used to call it my Mona Lisa face. And they said, well, you know, you seem rather amused. And I briefly told them what my situation had been, but not in details. And the one young woman said to me, my goodness, she said, you are a masochist, aren't you? And I amusingly returned and said, no, I wasn't a masochist. I loved a man, and if I wanted him, I was going to give him his responsibilities for him.
I'm going to put the machine on now. Judy, we would like to talk to you about your feelings of, and what your thoughts are concerning anti-Semitism that you have met through your life as a child on the North Side, and your husband's life working in a Gentile hospital most of his life, and you now working at the museum, where obviously there are more non-Jews than Jews.
Well, frankly, it had never become a real problem for me. But to say that I wasn't aware of the existence of anti-Semitism throughout my life would be very foolish. Now, I was raised in a Gentile community. The only Jewish people were my family and the children from the orphanage, and there may have been maybe two or three families in the area. As it exists today, it existed then. There were people that would call you a dirty Jew, or that would call you a sheenie, but I don't think it was a real problem for me, and I never felt ashamed of who I was, and I never wished that I was otherwise. And when I say that, I do have some very lovely Jewish friends who often say, wouldn't it be wonderful to be born Episcopalian? That I have never felt that I wanted to be. I am what I am, and I'm neither proud or unhappy about it. As far as in school, I always felt I had to work a little harder, but I was fortunate in being a good student, so it was never a problem. As far as in college, all the awards that were given, I sensed that being Jewish, I had to work a little harder, but truthfully, I must confess that in college, I wasn't much interested in awards. I was much more interested in boys. I was really much more interested in going to parties and having fun. And on the side, surreptitiously, I did my study. And I don't know whether I told you this story, but when I graduated from college, The man who later became my brother-in-law was sitting behind me in the stadium, and when the program came out and the only one was summa cum laude and the highest in the class was myself, he hit me over the head and he said, "Where have you been hiding it?" I just didn't feel it was necessary, and that was it. But I was aware that other honors Gentile people would get sooner than I would. But it never concerned me because it didn't mean that much to me. I guess I've always been pretty independent and pretty secure and quite self-sufficient. And if what I was doing satisfied me, I was never in competition with people. I still am not in my life. I am always unconsciously in competition with myself. In other words, as my husband used to say, you set very high standards. And if you're going to expect other people to meet those standards in the world, you're going to be continuously disappointed. And don't push yourself so much. But this is the way I am. Now, as far as Bob was aware all through his career of the fact that he was Jewish. It was never a problem for him, but he knew that he had to maintain a certain decorum, a certain dignity, and he had to behave beyond reproach, socially and professionally. And he did. And those who knew him knew that he was always a gentleman. He was an extremely attractive man. I don't say this is a compliment or not, but he was never taken for a Jew because of his fair skin and chestnut-colored hair and gray eyes and pudgy, turned-up nose. But he did not advertise his Jewishness, but he never, ever denied it or hid it any more than my son does in his situation as a professor at a university. He doesn't make an issue of it, but when an issue occurs about Jews, he takes a very definite stand. Sometimes when it can be a problem to him, but if there's an issue raised, he takes a definite stand. Now, what can I say? My husband, as you know, was affiliated with Mercy Hospital, a Catholic institution, Allegheny General, which was a very, very Presbyterian institution represented by the wealth of Swickley Heights on the board. We were friendly with these people. We didn't socialize, when I say coming and going, that type of socializing, but if there was a big party or something of that sort, we were always included. We were very friendly with the staff of the hospital, who was all, none of them were Jewish, and we had dinners at their home and vice versa. I've always lived in a mixed society, and I'm very grateful for it because I am always comfortable with anybody wherever I go. At this stage in life, I travel a great deal by myself, and I'm very comfortable with it. And interestingly enough, something turned up several weeks ago with one of my travel film speakers at the museum. I think it had to do with Schindler's List, and we were discussing it, and I said something. But, well, I schooled myself to it. I had read the book, and I knew about it. After all, my father's family went to the Holocaust. And this man, in a very startled manner, said, "You aren't Jewish, are you?" And I said, "Of course I am." Well, he just sort of seemed flabbergasted. Now, I have never denied my Jewishness, but we discussed it then further, and I said that, yes, I was Jewish, and yes, I did go to temple, and yes, I had a great deal of feeling about it, but I didn't, you know, wear it on my sleeve, and I didn't feel a need to discuss it unless the occasion arose. So Bob had a tremendous sense, much greater than I, of his feeling for being a Jew. Even though he was raised in an Orthodox home, they actually kept kosher in his home. When I got married, I kept kosher for many years, something I was unaccustomed to. And then after a while, it got ridiculous because we were serving food what his mother wanted, and whether it was kosher or not kosher, or whether it was mixing meat and milk, and after she left the household, we discontinued that because we were eating anything we wanted out, and we thought it was being sort of false. But though Bob did not go through all the ceremonials, he did have a great feeling about his Jewishness. I always lit candles every Friday night.
Now, my son, I must confess that now that I'm alone, I don't bother, because most Friday nights I go to the symphony and I don't want to leave the candles burning. When my son comes home, interestingly enough, he does not do it in his household. He is married to a non-Jew. But he always insists when he comes home on Friday night, he knows that I will have candles, that I will have wine, and I will help the challah to make the blessing. And he wants that done, and I do it. And it's sort of strange because he doesn't live like that at home, but it does remind him of his childhood. So somewhere we did instill the Jewishness tradition in him. As I said, he is married to a non-Jew. They are not affiliated. However, as I said before, when an issue comes up in his profession, he takes a stand. He definitely takes a stand so that his colleagues all know that he is Jewish. His wife is a non-practicing Catholic. She says she is an atheist, or I would rather say she's an agnostic than an atheist. But
she believes in God, but she doesn't keep to a...
she doesn't go to church at all. I don't think she's ever gone to church.
That there is a God.
Now, when they did go to visit her family in Poland this winter, they did go to a service or something on Christmas Eve. But interestingly enough, her family had planned all these events before they got there, and I guess they thought, because Myra was Jewish, they took them to the synagogue, they took them to the Jewish cemetery. I thought it was very interesting that his wife, Grzyna, took pictures of Bratz's grave. Bratz was the famous historian, the history of the Jews, got Bratz, and they took pictures of his grave, and this was the first thing he told me about when he came back. So his heritage
really is Jewish.
He is within him, and he feels that.
Did they keep kosher at the Dusky home? Never kept kosher.
No.
The children were given a glass of milk even if they had a hamburger dinner.
No. They never kept kosher there.
Because it was basically a reform type of institution.
It was not kosher. Never was kosher. What else can I say about the Jewishness?
Didn't have any problems at Allegheny General or at Noen, or did he? Or did
I
he make very light of it?
Well, he was able to always handle problems. But there were problems, as there would be for anybody in a non-Jewish situation. But it wasn't a problem that in any way prohibited him from functioning the way he wanted to function. He was highly respected over there. Of course, you know, he was the white Jew.
And he was different.
He was different than those other Jews. And we used to joke about it with him and say, I'm no different. You just don't know the rest of it.
Now, after he passed away, how long afterwards was it that they honored him through the Singer Laboratory? Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, actually, Bob had retired from the laboratory before he died. He had reached the age of retirement, and he had retired. He stayed on for about 2 years as a consultant with them. But I would say that he wasn't going over to the hospital for a good 2 years before he passed away. But when he did pass away, of course, they felt very strongly, and they wanted to honor him in some way. And they had an artist do a portrait of him. And, of course, the artist had never known Bob, so he would come to the house, and I would give him pictures, and he would ask me questions, and he would go and visit Bob's friends. As far as I was concerned, it sounds rather irreverent, but as far as I was concerned, it was a portrait of a dead man, because he had this expressionist, did not look like Bob. And I quit going to the sessions with the artist because it was taking too much out of me. And I felt that he would always feel that there was nothing he could do to that picture that would please me. So I would send my friends, and they would go and tell him he didn't get the twinkle in the eye. He didn't get the little crevice with the little cleft in the chin. He just didn't get the things that gave Bob his charming manner and his tremendous sense of humor, which people knew he had.